You're listening to the CryptoCast podcast.
Welcome to the Crypto and Blockchain Talk.
Hello.
Hey.
Guten Tag.
Aloha.
Kere.
Shalom.
Hallo.
Namaste.
Ni hao.
Vivet.
Hello.
Salut.
Yassas.
Salve.
Ciao.
Bonjour.
Our podcast talks about the latest trends in the worlds of cryptocurrencies and the blockchain. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Crypto and Blockchain Talk, where every week we cover a topic which we know is going to help you get smarter. Now, here this week, we have a person with us who goes by the name of Jonathan C. Dunsmore, and he happens to be a top U.S. securities attorney. And he does speak at many conferences and events regarding U.S. regulations for onshore and offshore entities. Now, first of all, I would like to welcome you to this interview, Jonathan. So welcome to Crypto and Blockchain Talk.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're really excited, and for many reasons. We also have a raft of questions to ask you, but I'm going to ask you this question in the very first place. How did you end up getting involved in the world of crypto?
That's a great question. First and foremost, let me say that all the answers that I give today are just for educational purposes. So none of this is considered legal advice or advice, investment advice whatsoever. But how I got involved in the blockchain space is I had clients come to me who were startups who were looking to raise funds, and they kept saying, let's do an ICO, let's do an ICO. And this was early 2016 in that kind of area, and one thing led to another, and we kept saying, no, this is not good, this is not good, you can't do this, it's not regulated, these things are securities. And that kind of slowly morphed into startups that actually wanted to delve in deeper and take a look and be registered instead of just coming up with a fancy white paper and a nice website and launching it. And so we kind of took a look at the exemptions from registration, the things that allowed you to not have to fully register with the SEC, which is a very long and difficult process. And so we use those exemptions to create ICOs that were registered offerings, are exempt from registration. And so that allowed, you know, the entire kind of market to kind of start shifting towards being compliant with the laws as opposed to being the Wild West and running ICOs for just the sheer will and force of the market. It was a very hectic time, but it was something that evolved over about 2 years.
I'm sure so many people who wanted to run an ICO came to you and said, can you help us do this? And of course, initially you said, no, you know, this is not legal. But was there then that turning point where you actually said, yeah, we're going to work on this ICO, or we can work on this and we can actually make this something legal? Or is this just something that you're in the landscape right now and you're helping to change the process of thought to make this whole entry point for people who want to run an ICO one that's easier and legal?
It's a combination of both. We started off with using, you know, the existing law that we had, and we helped clients use that law to raise money. From this point, we've been in this ecosystem, like I said, for about two, three years now. And we said, as a whole, as, you know, the people that I work with, the other great attorneys and the other great service providers here, especially from the traditional markets, have realized this is the future. Blockchain is the future, whether you care to admit it or not. It is safer. It's more secure. It's faster in a lot of ways. And so we are working diligently to bend the laws to our needs, but also change the law. We think that there are some outdated mechanisms that not only the U.S. government needs to change, but other governments around the world. And so that's what we're working towards. First, we worked within those boundaries, and now we're trying to change those boundaries.
Okay, so are you working hand in hand with the SEC, or how are you working alongside them?
The SEC has created a financial hub for who have innovative startups or innovative registrations, and we have been submitting basically applications to the SEC to figure out those kind of mechanisms to either change or evolve the regulations. The SEC doesn't make the law, it just interprets the law, and so they have a little bit more wiggle room when it comes to how these things are developed, specifically STOs and, you know, things that are actual securities and want to be registered securities and listed on an exchange. All of these is, you know, kind of new mechanisms that we haven't developed out yet. And so we're working with them to try to make these things work. You know, the SEC, for the most part, people think of it as a big, bad organization, when in reality, they're just a simple government-regulated organization that's trying to make things better and make sure that investors aren't hurt. The average everyday investor who loses, you know, their house because they, you know, went all in on a penny stock or something is who the SEC is trying to prevent, those types of fraud. And so for market participants, issuers, companies that want to behave properly, the SEC is completely fine in talking with them. We can call them up and talk about the offering. It's one of those things where it's very easy, especially if you have an attorney, to engage the SEC and figure out if this is working. Is this something that's going to be compliant? Now, if you just kind of go at it willy-nilly and run an ICO and don't talk to a lawyer or don't talk to anyone at all, I don't think anybody's doing that right now. I think that's kind of over and gone. But, you know, it's those types of mechanisms that need to change. There can't be any more actors in this space. There can't be any more people who are trying to do ICOs in 2018 and 2019 that are unregulated, that have, you know, no exemption from registration or not registered with a government entity. It just doesn't work anymore.
Right. Well, let's just talk about terminology for a minute, because we did actually say the three letters STO, which is security token offering, but we all know that the following three-letter acronyms have passed through everyone's speech in the last 2 years, and these are ITO, ICO, STO, TGE. Now I just saw DSO. Aren't we talking about the same thing? And I could go on, by the way, for the next 10 minutes throwing three letters together. But, I mean, these are all the same. We're talking about the same thing here, correct? I mean, an STO is an ICO.
Yes and no. So I use the traditional ICO as something that is either unregistered or doesn't need to be registered. And so it can be a good and a bad thing, just as an STO can be a good and a bad thing, too. But an ICO, at least in my mind, is a true utility token offering. And so if it's something where you have a beta, you have something that is up and running, a platform or a service, and I can basically pre-order, you know, my Mario tokens to play Mario, or my laundromat tokens, if some people, some listeners are that old, you know, those are a true ICO. That's a utility token. Whereas, you know, an STO says, look, I am a security every day. I'm not trying to hide it. I'm not trying to force any other false representation. You know, there's either dividend rights or there's voting rights or there's, you know, just equity. The digital share is basically just a digital share. You know, it's on a blockchain. That's the only thing that makes it different from book entry. And so I don't care what people call it. I have an article out that says, you know, I don't care what you try to, what new acronym you come up with. You know, it still matters what the legal test is. And so your clever marketing terms for DSO and all these other kind of things, I saw ICCO and all of these other silly acronyms to, I don't know if it's to separate them from the pack or to try to be the first cool guy or girl to say something that's going to catch on, but
it's to legitimize, I think, just to legitimize.
Well, some of them I think are to legitimize, and then the other ones I think are just almost trolling because they're ridiculous, and it makes sense that you're trying to say that you're, you know, complying with the law. You want to give that, you know, sense of security with the investment that people are making. But for the most part, I think that you're going to find the devil's in the details. You know, does the company have proper representation? Do they have a white paper that has legal disclaimers? Do they have, you know, an MVP, or do they have, you know, this grandiose plan that is completely doable, but the amount of funds that they're going to raise are going to be something that's going to be at least capable of getting them to stage one. You know, if I'm Elon Musk and I'm trying to do an ICO or an STO, and I'm trying to build SpaceX, well, that first number that I'm shooting for better get me to, you know, a solid MVP. I better be able to test a rocket. It may not have to fly. It may fly right into the ground, or it may, you know, stay on land, but it's got to get to that point. There's a lot of institutional investors, and that's really going to open up the entire market, that are taking a look at this space and realizing there's a lot of potential here. And so as soon as we clear the way for those folks to enter, I think you're going to see a lot of really incredible, innovative projects get funded, and teams that normal angels and VCs, while I love those guys and girls to death, they only fund the things that they like, the people that they like. UPS, I believe it's UPS, has a venture arm, and he said, and I can't remember the guy's name, I apologize for that, but, he said that 50% of his decision is just if he likes the person. And so if he does not like the person, they don't get funded. And that's an absolutely incredible kind of statistic. A true STO will allow institutional investors to play. It will allow everyday investors to play under Regulation A+ in the U.S., and it will open up the entire world market to just an absolute kind of capital revolution and venture revolution that we've never seen in this world before. It's, when I say it's bigger than the internet, it's bigger than the internet. And most people don't understand that, don't grasp it. But the same way that you can feel comfortable in putting in your credit card to Amazon or other websites right now, you will feel comfortable in being able to buy property in, the Middle East or South America or Africa or, developed countries that don't really have a good registration system. I mean, hell, I'm from South Carolina and we don't have a land registry that's, available in all counties. My cousins have to go, who own a title abstract company, they have to go to the courthouse to look at the books. That's insane. This is a first world country.
It's such an old method of tackling something that should be so simple. But I'm also going to say at this point that we actually have also done a podcast on blockchain and real estate where we actually cover how Sweden has done exactly the thing that Jonathan here is suggesting. They have a solution for anything to do with land registry, titles of houses, etc. So let me first ask you this. What makes a security token?
If someone is saying they are a security token, they've accepted it at this point. You know what I mean? They want to be a security token. And I think that's the vast majority of the world right now. I think they recognize that whether you understand the Howey test and can apply it properly that's easy. It's the utility people that we still have to go do a deep dive in. And at that point, what we look for simply is, it's usable outside of the platform. Can you cash out? And is it on a secondary market? If either one of those happen, if I am able to cash out my Mario tokens or I am able to trade my Mario tokens, then guess what? You're probably a security, and or at least a commodity. And so at that point, you have some type of registration obligation almost anywhere in the world. And the people that keep screaming that, oh, I'm a utility, it's cool, you can invest in me, they're going to suffer, and their investors are going to suffer, and their companies are going to suffer, because it simply doesn't work. If you raise a bunch of money, even in parts of the world where they're still doing ICOs, which are slowly dying out, they're not going to be able to access the U.S. market. And to not have access to the largest market in the world, to me, is a bad business decision. And so it is better to, find the proper guidance, whether it's a securities attorney or whether it's, a CPA or anyone who kind of understands this space a little bit and guide you along the way. I do not pretend to know how to do programming or any of this type of really high level blockchain development. But you know what? I find people who do, and then I make sure those people find other people who do. And that's how we build out a system. Whereas, if I'm trying to do something that is above my level of understanding, I'm going to find an expert. And I highly encourage people to do that as well. And not to say that I'm an expert or anything. We don't use that term in the United States, especially lawyers. But what we do is we try to find the folks that can help evolve the business, evolve the development, anything like that. And that's the critical part. That's the part that matters. So saying you're an ICO and you're a utility, you've got to prove that. And I think my test is much easier than going through the Howey test of, whether this is an investment contract and all these silly things. If your customer is able to cash out in any form of payment And if they're able to take that to a secondary exchange, if they meet either one of those tests, guess what? You should probably be regulated and you should not be taking investor money.
That is so important, everything that you just said, that I'm going to repeat it. So you are not a utility token if you can trade on the secondary market or you can cash out in any form of payment. Is that correct, Jonathan?
That is correct.
Absolutely important. And do you know what? That is a very simple test. How is this going to be now spreading and infiltrating throughout the rest of the regulatory authorities in the world?
That's a fantastic question. I mean, as I've stated, you know, the U.S. market is the largest market in the world. And so people want to do business here. I mean, it's just almost a necessity for anything tech related or anything long term, development related. You can't wipe out an entire market, especially the markets that's the largest. And so, as I've said, you can't run an illegal ICO and then hope to access the U.S. market, especially if you're going to try to raise money there eventually, because the regulators aren't going to allow it. At least they'll eventually not allow it, or you receive a cease and desist order. And so, you know, all of these types of, oh, we're going to leave the U.S. or, you know, we don't care what the U.S. is going to do because we're registered in Malta and Gibraltar and Estonia and all these other places. We're outside of their jurisdiction. Yeah, I mean, that's true for now, but the SEC and the FBI and everybody else will find you if you're doing especially fraudulent activity. And so if you're really trying to build businesses, if you're really trying to build a company and you want to make your investors happy, the best thing to do is comply with the law. And if you can't figure out the law, then find someone who can. If you can't understand what's going forward in the country that you want to operate in, then find someone who will help you. The Canadians, for example, are far, far more ahead of us than this. They have insurance for custody, and they have all of these other kind of developments that are slowly coming along. The guys at Polymath are doing pretty good, trying to figure out, you know, how to do a proper STO. They still have a long road ahead of them, but I mean, you know, it's a matter of keeping up with the markets that you want to be in and making sure that you do not make anyone upset, especially if they're big and powerful like the United States is in industry. And it just doesn't make sense to anger someone that large.
Okay. Well, as you know, our offices are based in Europe, and there are many ICOs, even though they're based in Europe, who are actually, for some reason, putting themselves in other places such as Singapore or Malaysia or somewhere else. So there's a whole combination of places where people are located in terms of physical location, and then they're moving their corporate offices to somewhere else because of all of this. But let's just take an example. Let's just pretend that there's a Latvian company who's doing a Latvian ICO. Can they do their offering legally in the United States if they haven't done, you know, because obviously they're not based in the United States, but they want to get U.S. investors. And then can you help me compare that to another Latvian ICO who perhaps bases themselves in Singapore? What are the differences if they want to attract the U.S. market?
If they want to attract the U.S. market, especially if the investors in the U.S. are non-accredited, then they really can't do much. I mean, the U.S. doesn't have the ability to police the world in the sense of, you know, shut down every startup or every ICO that's conducting an ICO in Singapore or Latvia or, you know, anywhere else in the world, really. It's not their directive to do that, but they will do what they can to shut down things that are U.S.-based or with U.S. persons. And so if you are a U.S. citizen and you are thinking you're being clever by opening your company in Estonia or Gibraltar or Latvia or Singapore or Malaysia, guess what? That doesn't put you outside of SEC's purview. And so they can use their jurisdictional rights to basically create hell for you in the United States, which I assume you're still based in. If they do move abroad and they do set up a company abroad and they do have non-American partners and it dilutes their portion to where they're basically a minority investor, then that's a little bit different. But for the most part, if you're trying to get access to U.S. investors, then you have to register with an exemption. And whether that is an exemption under, you know, Reg D or Reg S or anything like that, it's one of those things where you have to comply with law or else there can be trouble down the way. And I'm not saying it's going to be instantaneously. I'm not saying it's going to be something where, you know, you pop up a website and you get in trouble or you get an email later. But it's one of those things where if you're truly trying to build a company long term and large scale, you can't conduct illegal offerings. You will not be able to do a registered offering after you've conducted an illegal offering. And so that's very important regardless of where you are in the world. If you're a Singapore company and you conduct a legal offering and then you try to come to the U.S. to do a registered offering because you need more money, you won't be able to do that.
Okay, so you talked about something called a Reg D or a Reg S. Is that correct?
Yes.
What are you talking about?
Yes. So Regulation D, 506C, is the exemption from registration that most STOs use right now. That is the provision of the law that allows for accredited investors, rich folks, basically, to spend their money however they please. And that is what we have been using in the U.S. in combination with Regulation F that allows for accredited investors offshore to participate under their own jurisdictional requirements. And so that is the only kind of STO we have, is Reg D and slash S. And it's limited. It doesn't allow everyday average normal folks to participate in ICOs or STOs. And that's why it's kind of, you know, hurt the overall crypto market, is once these things started to become mainstream and ICOs became a household name, you know, the SEC and everybody else started really writing articles and cracking down on these illegal offerings, which has led to basically what has been the bloodbath of 2018. But, you know, that kind of cleansing was necessary to clean up the unregistered, illegal ad offerings. I mean, there was an offering out of China, I believe, that had a picture of Ryan Gosling as one of the advisors, and
yeah,
his name was Brian Kinsler or something. I mean, these types of offerings are just something that hurts the entire world economy when we have things like that. And so we want to have regulation. We want to use these exemptions registration to permit large-scale offerings, but we also need things like what will be a true STO under Regulation A+, which will be a $50 million offering, including non-accredited investors, so average everyday folks. But the SEC hasn't granted one of those yet. There's about 50 of them lined up at the SEC's door, and they're all in various stages of getting through the process, but nobody has cleared registration yet. And so once that happens, once there is a true STO Reg A Plus that's available to accredited investors and non-accredited investors, I truly believe that this market will open up tremendously. Now, that being said, there also needs to be a place to trade this. And I know there's a bunch of really brilliant folks that are working on that as well. But in order to have an offering, you also need to have liquidity and give the investors the ability to cash out and trade and have market makers, large investment banks. We don't have a large crypto investment bank yet. I represent one of them, Tokenomics, who's trying to develop that market and really work with people to make sure that there is liquidity in their true STO. But it's a slow process because, like I said, we're moving the boundaries of the law. We're trying to work with the SEC and other regulators to make sure that this innovation thrives and doesn't die on the vine.
So if somebody wants to actually go through the legal process and find someone like you, because they really should not, I mean, I don't want to say that somebody shouldn't do this whole process of registering their tokens as securities on their own. Of course, people can. But let's just say that somebody actually realized that they should not be doing this because they're probably not legal experts. What would this whole process cost approximately? Or is that asking how long is a piece of string?
It is asking how long a piece of string is. Right now, you know, the offerings can really vary. It's almost about a $10,000 minimum, but it can go up as high as $1 million between legal fees and marketing costs and all these other kind of things. But if you had a small offering where it was, you know, people that you knew and people that you had possibly met at conferences, which would fall under, you know, Regulation D, 506C, and they're all accredited investors, or, you know, there's a 506B, which is a little bit, gives you a little bit more wiggle room where you can take on non-accredited investors.
But you can't publicly advertise it. So you can't talk about your ICO. You can't shout it from Twitter and Telegram and all these other kind of things. But there's a number of mechanisms that can be used. And so it depends on which mechanism you use to, you know, kind of grant access to that. And it just occurred to me that I forgot to mention Regulation CF, which is being used by a couple platforms in the U.S. To raise $1,070,000. And that one is not bad, but it is also not a lot of money. And so for $1 million, if you're trying to go to the moon and you're trying to develop something that is like a SpaceX rocket, you've got to be very careful with your budgeting. And don't get me wrong, I've seen some really great startups bootstrap their way up. But when you're talking about large development costs, when you're talking about possibly outsourcing some of your, you know, marketing or things of that nature, those costs can rise. And so $1,070,000 is not bad. If you've got a 1 year runway, which is what CF gives you, you can conduct our one offering in 12 month period. So you can do another one after that 12 months. But it kind of, you've got to have a little bit of traction. You have to have at least $10,000 to kind of, you know, do the marketing and get everything going. And then you better have a lot of people who are going to support it. Because if you don't, and you don't ring that bell and cash it out, then I hope you're able to develop whatever you have at, you know, that lower offering price, whether it's $100,000, whether it's $200,000. Because if not, your investors are going to be very, very upset. And anytime that happens, it's not good for business. It's not good for generally that person's mental health and well-being, because it's very stressful when your investors are mad.
Are you saying $1,070,000? I just want to clarify that as well. $1,070,000?
It is $1,070,000. It's a really weird number. And I can't remember.
That is a really strange arbitrary number. What the hell is that about?
You know, I can't remember. I read the registration years ago when it came out under the Jobs Act, but it was just such a weird number. And I think they were trying to include like the brokerage fees in there and try to make it so, you know, the company actually had a hard million and stuff like that. But legislators and things of that nature have good intentions sometimes, and then they throw in something arbitrary or muck something up. And so,
yeah, and that falls under that line. So let me just put a scenario here. So, you know, I'm an American-based pretend ICO manager, and I just don't know this stuff, and I'm just plain naive, and I get it all wrong. What happens to me? What's the worst that can happen?
The worst that can happen to you is, and we've seen this recently with SEC orders, is that you can be fined a bunch of money, and you could possibly have criminal charges against you, depending on what you've said and what you've done. If you've promised these investors that you're going to be developing some world-class app, and you've been spending it on lavish parties and pretty girls and Lamborghinis, then you're probably going to go to jail. There's no way around that unless you have a way of basically giving all the money back. And I mean all the money back plus interest. And so that's kind of the worst case scenario. If you do or have conducted an ICO and you're worried about registration now, you're thinking, God, you know, I want to have access to the U.S. markets and I'm afraid I've blocked myself off, then we can do a rescission order. Which basically, depending on the jurisdiction and what's happened, we give all of the money back, or we do a rescission offer, which allows investors, which is what happened in the federal cases, we allow the investors to possibly take their money back or keep their tokens. And so those are kind of the best case scenarios. If God forbid, you know, you received a call from a regulator, or received an email, or received a letter, or you've realized that, you know, oh my God, you know, we may have done something illegal. We need to talk to someone. There's plenty of resources out there. There's a lot of really good articles from a lot of really bright securities attorneys in this space. And I highly encourage you to, you know, Google Foo as much as you can and try to get an understanding. But when you reach that point where you can't understand anymore, that's when you have to hire an expert. At least talk to one and figure out what to do for your next steps, especially if you're trying to, you know, work within the boundaries of the law and make sure that what you're doing is compliant hereforth.
Now, you see, this is also interesting because I read the other day that the state of Colorado issued 3 cease and desist orders, and they had to show up for some kind of preliminary hearing. These are the ICO people themselves, and they never showed up. What's going to happen to those people?
That's a good question. It really depends on where those people are located, and it depends on what actions they've done. And so if they've taken fraudulent actions, the FBI can basically chase them down. If it's something on the criminal side, they have really, really powerful people. And the FBI and the SEC and the DOJ, the Department of Justice, work hand in hand. And so they have the FBI go collect people. I mean, that's what happened to Bernie Madoff in the traditional markets. A lot of the states have taken kind of a proactive approach. We've handled some of the enforcement actions, is what they're called, across the country. And it's one of those matters where it is better to answer the call and take the email and answer, even if it's, something that's sent out and you didn't receive it, but it got, caught on the press winds and you learned about it through Twitter that you've been issued a cease and desist, then you need to address it. You need to take that proactive action to make sure that you do not have that final order against you, because once that order is final, it costs more money to get it removed or possibly do a deal with the state and try to make yourself compliant. And so it is absolutely crucial that if you believe that you've got a cease and desist order, or one may be coming, or you've seen one from, your neighbor down the street who's doing the same thing you are, to get in contact with a professional. It doesn't have to be me. Of course, it doesn't have to be me, but it is one of those things where you do not want to go at that alone, and you do not want to go at that by ignoring it. It does not make sense. It will make your life much, much worse.
So you know how obviously things work in the United States. Is there a country out there that you think, wow, their security laws are amazing and everything to do with their regulations on securities, we need to mirror that? What country is that? Now, I know you mentioned Canada before, but is that the one that you think they're the poster children for security tokens? Which country?
I wouldn't say Canada's the poster children because they don't have an STO yet. Coral, I believe, is the first company that has applied for the Canadian STO label through Polymath, and they have not been approved yet. As far as who's got the best laws, Malta, Gibraltar, Estonia, all of you guys are working with kind of a sandbox arena. I know Malta has some really good kind of laws on the books, but they're still an EU country. They still have to abide by EU regulations, and so it's one of those things where you've got to make sure all of your P's and Q's are crossed, or you're going to get into trouble. And while I think that eventually we will almost have a consensus of what an STO looks like from a regulatory standpoint in Europe and the US and Canada, and then, China and Singapore and Hong Kong and all these other kind of places. But right now it's just kind of a matter of, if I'm offering my services in an STO, do they meet those requirements under that jurisdiction? If they have a Japanese citizen who wants to invest, we have to, do the analysis of where they are, what they're doing, are they accredited investor, that entire process. And so while people may have really good laws on the books, or they're slowly starting to develop them, Wyoming in the U.S. has got some really good stuff. So does Arizona. But when you're doing large international offering, they almost don't matter as much as, where is the money coming from. So even though you may be compliant in the U.S., you may not be compliant elsewhere. You may not, of course, in the U.S., you can't be dealing with investors from Iran. And so that's a big red flag for, KYC AML. And that's one of the things that this industry is slowly starting to grasp, that we have these requirements because this is basically international money. And it's not something you want to go at by yourself. Like I said, educate yourself to the point where you don't understand it anymore, and then find someone who can help you get to that last 10, 20, 30%.
So in terms of utility tokens, just coming back to this for a moment, official utility tokens that stick out in your mind, who are they besides Bitcoin?
That's a great question. So I think Ethereum, of course, is the quintessential utility. I think that shows that you can have something that is an ICO and move to a utility. I think that is the one that I kind of give as the poster child. Bitcoin is a currency more than it is a utility, which is a whole different kind of subset of this entire crazy world of ours, where you don't really build on top of Bitcoin. It is more used as a transactional means of holding value. And so in that sense, it has this security element to it, but it's basically just a currency. And so I don't want to list any favorites, confidential reasons. Yeah, so...
Okay, that's fine. Okay, now securities in general, and when we're talking about money and assets and stocks and everything else, because obviously this is going to be eventually, once they're loved and accepted by the SEC and that whole model is finally put in concrete, how do you think people and their investment portfolios are going to look at crypto in the same way that they look at the classic assets and stocks and investments? Or how long do you think the stigma around crypto is going to last?
the good news is the vast majority of the public's memory is very, very fleeting. And so once people start making money, real money again, off of crypto or blockchain investments, people are not going to give a damn. You know, whether it's you watching Shark Tank or Dragon's Den or any of the other shows and seeing a QR code where you're able to scan and invest, you know, read the financial documents, read the registration statements, and actually contribute because you like the product or you like the service or you like the team, that's when people are going to start really getting excited about things. And then once they start realizing those returns, whether it's because they've invested as an individual or because their financial advisor who, I can't mention the names of the financial advisors that we're talking to, but there's so many of them right now that want to be in this space. They understand that this stuff is going to change their industry, and they want to be able to give those returns to their clients, not only because it makes them look good, but it also helps, make them money. And so once that happens, you know, once your IRA or your 401k is on the blockchain, or you have an investment portfolio in that 401k that is STO related, I think people are just going to forget about the crazy days, in the sense that they won't be worried about them. They'll remember them. We'll laugh about this stuff later, and of how wild it was. But, you know, once most stocks and most shares are digitized on the blockchain, I think it's just going to become a natural kind of course of action. It's just going to be like using the internet. You know, we can't imagine not having it now, but I grew up in an era where the late 90s, we didn't have the internet. You know, it wasn't something that we carried around a phone. And so it's crazy to think about it now, but I think we're going to think the same thing about blockchain. We're going to know that, you know, when we process a credit card transaction, it's going to be a lot cheaper. It's going to be a lot more efficient. We know the money's going to be there. You know, all of those Nigerian scams or Port-au-Prince scams kind of thing where I'm a rich prince and I'm going to send you all this money. All of that stuff's going to go away because we're going to say, okay, you know, send it to my bank account that's backed by blockchain. I mean, Bank of America's got more patents than anybody in this financial industry on blockchain, and there's a reason why. It's not because they are hedging their bets, because they believe in it and they don't want to tell people that, especially their retail customers. But on the end, they're having their lawyers file patents left and right. And so it's one of those things where it's going to make the world a lot safer. And as soon as people start realizing that it's going to make them safer and more money, this entire industry is going to erupt.
I totally agree with you. And it's so nice to meet somebody of a like mind. And like-minded people are always best sticking together. So what I would like to say is the following. You have been a fantastic person for Crypto and Blockchain Talk. I really do think that you've educated many people during this program session. We would love to have you back one day. What do you think?
I'd be honored. I'd love to.
Oh, fabulous. Oh, well, we'd love to have more fun with you. And we would like to thank Jonathan C. Dunsmore, who has been amazing. And I've got to tell you, if we have any questions, we're going to come straight to you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me.
Oh, no. Pleasure's all been ours. Thanks again, everyone. And thank you for listening. And we look forward to having you as our listener next week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks for listening to the CryptoCast podcast. Stay tuned in for more episodes.